You are listening to Service Course by The Cycling Podcast with Lizzie Banks and Tom Whalley.
Well, it's pointless asking, but where are we, Lizzie?
We're at home. Again. Still. But it's
in our separate homes.
Yeah, in our separate homes. We're not in the same home. But it's really good, actually, because it's raining. And I'm really happy to see, because we've had a month of sunshine, which has been glorious. But our beloved country has been drying out. So I'm pretty happy that we're now going to have a month of rain. And it's a little frustrating because it was due to be the women's tour this month. And if it was going to throw it down, we know I'd have probably won that race.
Yeah, you do like racing in the bad conditions. Talking about racing in, you're going to be racing in good conditions because you're actually going to be racing quite soon, right?
Yeah, I know. I've got a race coming up in 2 weeks' time. It's the inaugural women's e-tour and it's 3 days of racing on the RGT platform, which is the same platform that the Cycling Podcast used for our Giro, which is really cool. So I think it's going to be broadcast live on the BBC as well. So if you're in the UK, then check it out.
So you'll tweet about that. So follow you, I guess, on Twitter, and you'll sling out a link when the racing's starting.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully it should be something exciting and something a bit different to watch.
And you've been doing the ideal prep by eating your way around virtual Italy as well during the Giro.
Eating and drinking my way around virtual Italy. Yeah, it's been interesting preparation, but no, it's been really, really good fun. I've been joining in with Lionel as he's been cooking his way around Italy. And then even on the days when he wasn't cooking, we were kind of finding new recipes and drinking some of the delicious wine from Divine Cellars that was part of the Baby Giro box. So yeah, it's been really fun. It's been something a bit different to do, and you know, it's just been weirdly nice to spend some time at home. Obviously I wish we weren't in the middle of a global pandemic, but you never get to spend time at home, especially during this time of the year. So it's actually something quite different and kind of weirdly enjoyable. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that I'm enjoying spending time at home, but yeah, I am.
What's your experience of indoor racing, by the way, Lizzie? Have you done a Strava race, done anything like that at all in the past?
I did a little bit of Zwift racing last year. Our team were in...
I meant a Zwift race,
yeah,
of course, not a Strava
race. I know.
A Zwift race.
Good job, Tom, on a tech podcast, screwing it up. But never mind, we'll just forget about that. I did a little bit of Zwift racing last year, but I've never raced on RGT. So, yeah, I'm going to give it a go over the next few days and try and, see what it's going to be like. And I don't know. I think... real racing is my thing, but for the time being it's good to have something, and it's good for the fans as well to have a bit of engagement because we've got nothing else right now.
Okay, so this is all going to be taking place in your pain cave. Can you sort of paint a picture of where you're going to be racing from?
I would love to, but it's just my dining room. So if you look on my Instagram, then you can see what my dining room is like. And I will have, hopefully this nice cooler weather will continue because it'll be slightly less unpleasant then. You know, have the window wide open, my soigne at the ready with maybe some ice packs to shove down my neck and plenty of fluids, because you always just... absolutely sweat buckets when you're doing these things. Just when you're doing a normal training ride, I sweat buckets. So gonna get the electrolytes down and get the Mars bars in as well.
It's gonna be really interesting watching how you guys race that, actually, because obviously you guys race together on the road, and a road race has a certain rhythm, but when people race on these virtual platforms, the rhythm is just normal. Well, my experience, it's just completely different. It's, you know, sprint from the start and then try and hold it for as long as possible, it seems.
Yeah, it's funny. I think people always ask about, you know, tactics and stuff in e-racing, and I don't really think there are many tactics. Also, in this race, there's only 3-man teams, so, you know, it's really very limited, because if someone gets dropped and you're just on your own, and it's really just hell for leather from the start and just who can cling on and who's kind of got the most power. And sometimes, you know, it's really stupid little things. It's like when the acceleration is, and I don't know about RGT actually, because I've not raced on RGT, but with Zwift, if you just miss that initial acceleration because there's a lag or something like that, then it's not possible, like in a normal road race, to do an acceleration and get back on. You just simply can't close the gap. You know, you can find that you're doing an effort of like 450 watts and you're just making no inroads. So it's pretty crazy, really. You have to kind of anticipate what's coming up and then, just ride at threshold for an hour, basically, with extra spikes.
Well, this episode, Lizzie, so we've talked about virtual racing and we've talked about our Giro, which was a look back at some classic races. This episode is all about a cycling event that should have just happened, but didn't take place, obviously, because of the global pandemic. What can you tell us about this episode?
So this month, we're talking all about Hoob Watt Bike, which is the UK track trade team that took on the world. And we're going to be looking back at their inception through to where they are now and to their record-breaking attempts, which they should have just done. But we can't start this episode without mentioning the latest hot tech on the block. And do you know what that is, Tom?
I think it's some nice, snazzy new kit, isn't it? Some new jerseys.
It is. And if you've been tuning into the regular podcast, you will know that the Cycling Podcast have just released their new training kit and an awesome t-shirt in collaboration with Katusha. And they look really great, actually. I can't wait to get my hands on them. It's a super nice design for the jersey, both in men's and women's jerseys. And then there's a great t-shirt with, you know, incorporate some of the best phrases from the Cycling Podcast over the years. So go to Katusha and you can reserve yours now, and hopefully the production will be pretty soon. But they look great, so don't delay, get your hands on them.
Well, I've got my Stacey Snyder mug, I've got my box of Giro wine, I just need the jersey now.
You know, you're pretty lucky that you've got your Stacey Snyder mug. I actually had a conversation with someone the other day who messaged me saying, did you manage to get your Stacey Snyder mug? Because I've been trying and I was 8 minutes in and I missed it. So, yeah, very rare those, Tom.
Well, do you know how I got it? A friend bought it for me. That's how I got mine. I didn't get one for being part of the Cycling Podcast. Okay, well, before we get onto Hoob Watt Bike, and I'm really excited to listen to all this because you've done a lot of interviews with them, and the thing about that team is they are just such great innovators, and had they been able to do their series of world record attempts, we would have seen some incredible innovation in action. But before we get to them, let's do a quick news roundup. I've got a few little stories I've picked up over the month for you, Lizzie. I don't know if you've seen all of these, but first one I want to talk about was the first indoor cycling shoe. So obviously the COVID-19 pandemic has forced people to do a lot more indoor riding on the turbo, and Nike have released what they're claiming is the first indoor specific training shoe.
Well, that's pretty interesting because Nike have been in partnership with Mark Cavendish for a long time. But as far as I'm aware, Nike don't actually make the shoes. Somebody else makes the shoes and then Mark and Nike get them, you know, painted up with a Nike swoosh on them. So that's interesting. And I'm not quite sure what the difference is between an indoor shoe and an outdoor shoe. Maybe you can tell me, Tom, is there a bit more ventilation?
Well, I can tell you there's two things, stability and breathability, apparently. But I mean, you know, I mean, I'm someone who's doing all my riding indoors at the moment. I can't get out at the moment. So something, anything that could keep me a bit cooler would appeal to me. But this next story, again, right in your wheelhouse, Lizzie, I reckon. I think crowdfunding and these sort of crowdfunding projects are one of the best places to find interesting new cycling tech. And I've been following this company called Body Rocket, and they've raised $250,000 and smashed their funding target. What it is, essentially, it is real-time aerodynamic analysis while you're riding your bike using sensors.
Well, I mean, we've already got that on the market. That's something that we're going to talk about later, but No Show Connect is something that Hoob Watt Bike have been using. So that's interesting. I wonder what the price point is, and I wonder if it's going to be able to, you know, compete with that maybe.
Well, it's interesting because obviously we're kind of an early stage in these sorts of sensors, and there are different. It'd be interesting to see which strategy sort of takes off. You know, people have talked about wearable tech doing it. This is three sensors, so one in the seat post, one in the stem, and then obviously it uses the power through your crank. But really interesting, and I mean, I think it's something that we will see become ubiquitous in cycling in future. Another crowdfunding story, and this is Hindsight, which was set up by Callum Skinner and a physicist friend of his, Alex McDonald. It's essentially cycling glasses that offer you a rear view. it's quite difficult to explain how it works, so I got them to do it for us. But we start off by talking about a very, 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 very powerful laser, which I know you'll love.
I studied a Master's in Physics at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, and hidden deep in an underground bunker not far from the centre of Glasgow, you know, George Square. If you've ever been to Glasgow, you've been to George Square. There is a very big concrete bunker hidden underground which houses what I believe is still the UK's most powerful laser, which is, it's a petawatt laser. So for a sense of scale, if you were to take all of the sunlight, and just to be clear, I did, just to make sure I was getting my numbers right, do the maths on this the other day. If you were to take all of the sunlight which is hitting the Earth from the sun in one unit time, say a second, and compress it down into the size of a human hair, so all the way from east to west, every bit of sunlight hitting the Earth in one place, and then you shot our laser next to it, it would be 1,000 times more powerful than all of the sunlight put together in that same unit time. So it's pretty ridiculously powerful, hence the incredibly big concrete doors and everything. So it's quite a beast, really. So we were using that for, it was called the Alpha X laser at the time, and I was responsible for redesigning the alignment of what are called quadrupoles, which are basically big electromagnetic lenses. Because if you're firing a laser that's that powerful into a glass lens, the glass lens is just going to vaporize. So you need to find something more interesting to steer the laser, and we did that using electromagnetic forces.
Obviously, the products itself are glasses that allow you to effectively see what's coming behind you. Now, as a kid, I remember, like, they used to sell these sort of spy glasses in the back of magazines, which would have, like, effectively just a wing mirror in the corner of each glasses. But yours are very different to that. So can you describe how your technology works?
Yeah, absolutely. So the spyglasses comment is something that we get a lot, because obviously they were hugely popular. Certainly you used to get them in magazines and all this kind of stuff. You know, you'd save up some tokens and then you'd send away for a pair of spyglasses.
I'm glad someone else remembers that as well. It wasn't just me.
No, there's plenty of them around, absolutely. The problem is that they're not really well designed when it comes to cycling. If you were to use a pair of spyglasses, you'd have quite a significant number of issues come forward. So we took something of a similar concept to that. We wanted to take something which naturally sits on the head and doesn't really interfere with the forward vision, which is kind of the main thing that we really wanted to optimize for. Because obviously, as a cyclist, you can't really call something useful to a cyclist if it stops you being able to see what's happening ahead of you. So one thing we spent a lot of time on was the optimization of the mirror. So the way the lenses work is they have a fully integrated angled mirror. So it's the first time anybody's trying to develop a lens like this, which is effectively a two-part lens, with one part of it being an internal mirrored coating. So the mirrored coating is actually mostly transparent, so it allows you to choose where you can focus your vision. So we've got one or two little videos on the Kickstarter page which will explain this and kind of demonstrate it, but it's really hard to describe even visually how the glasses work without giving somebody a pair. I mean, Callum could attest to this when he tried them, he just got them. But because as a human you have the ability to choose where your visual focus lies, if you choose to look in the mirrored portion, then you're able to see what's coming behind you. And if you choose to look through the mirrored portion, you're able to basically just see straight through it. So it's got a lot of functionality in terms of just giving you the choice. I mean, that's kind of one of the main things that the hindsight glasses have really brought forward and brought into sharp relief, is the ability to give control back to cyclists in a way which they haven't had before. Because one thing we say a lot is that every other vehicle on the road is required by law to have rearview mirrors. And fundamentally, cyclists are left with no good options at this point, apart from getting a very painful neck. The number of people who've messaged me in the campaign just to say, I cannot tell you how happy I'm going to be not having to turn my stiff neck anymore to see what's going on behind me, is incredible. Plus, there's an interesting little artifact based on human vision, which is that it's an interesting little area which not most people are aware of. So if you take your actual full visual field, most people can see something like 170 degrees looking straight ahead of them. But in terms of the part of your eye which is HD, that's effectively the size of your thumbnail. So if you put your arm outstretched and look at your thumbnail, that's the size of your visual field, which is HD, right? So if you look back, as we call it classically, i.e. over the shoulder, then you're just looking out the corner of your eye, right? And I mean, everybody who's ever seen a monster in the corner of their bedroom knew it happened at the corner of your eye, because the corner of your eye is not a good way of actually telling what's actually there. So with hindsight glasses, you can use the HD part of your eye. So it's effectively a whole upgrade in terms of the visual clarity you can use to identify what's behind you. So this means that when you're using a pair of hindsight glasses, you can look behind you and you can see the number plate of the car. You can see if the driver's texting, or the number one use that I've found of it so far is to see if a driver has actually acknowledged either that I'm braking or that I've made a turn signal.
So where do you see the application for these? I mean, obviously, we were talking a bit earlier before we started recording about how we're in a period now where a lot of people are either coming back to cycling or they are taking up cycling for the first time. And obviously, confidence and safety is a big part of that. But then you come from, you know, the elite level of the sport. Can you see these appealing to everyone across the spectrum?
Yeah, for sure. I think to segment it off a little bit from the performance aspect, like I spent most of my career either with my chin on my shoulder looking behind me, which is a big skill in track cycling, you know, for laps at a time. So it'd be quite nice not to contort my neck into that position after every training session. And the other major fundamental element was focusing on maintaining an aerodynamic position and a biomechanically efficient position. Now, all of that work is essentially rendered useless by the time that you twist your body to look behind you. So that's where I can kind of see the performance benefits with this product. And then when it comes to, you know, your commuter, hobbyists, you know, club rider, I just think it's you know, it's an issue of safety. I think everyone's experienced that close pass moment. Most of us kind of think, you know, oh shit. And Alex had the foresight to be able to develop a product which actually pragmatically and fundamentally has resolved this problem. And I appreciate that a lot of cyclists out there are very kind of fashion conscious. There's a reason why you don't see everyone going around in a high-vis vest. But fundamentally, these glasses look like any other ordinary glasses. You're not going to have a clamp-on mirror to the side of your handlebars. You're not going to have to charge up batteries for a rear view camera. It's simply out of the box, ready to go.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast and Service Course. You can get 25% off your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. Science in Sport launched a new product this week, a performance nitrate range formulated to deliver effective doses of dietary nitrates to support loading, pre-exercise and intra-exercise usage. The key performance benefit is that nitrates improve muscle efficiency by reducing the oxygen cost of exercise and maximising endurance performance, enabling athletes to go harder for longer. The SIS Performance Nitrate range includes gels, bars, powders, shots, and use rhubarb juice concentrate and amaranthus leaf extract as unique sources of nitrates, providing a superior taste profile and delivering a higher nitrate dose compared to anything else on the market. Supplementing with nitrates can improve running economy or cycling efficiency by reducing the oxygen cost of exercise. For more information on the performance nitrate range, see scienceinsport.com. And remember, you can get 25% off your Science in Sport order with the code SISCP25. All right then, Lizzie. So, Hoob What Bike, over to you.
Yeah, let's get back to where we started. And really, we're going to start at the end of the story for the British track team Hoob What Bike. The recent change in UCI rules last year banned trade teams from competing in the Track World Cups. And that spelled the end for the likes of Hoob What Bike and the Dutch team Beat, who you also might have heard of. But with every challenge that had been thrown at the team in the past, these guys just saw this as another opportunity. So just a couple of weeks ago, they were due to have been up at altitude in Bolivia to make an assault on pretty much all the track records out there. The last 3 months, you know, they've been intensively and specifically training with just this in mind, and everything had been dedicated and focused on this goal, with 3 altitude training camps, thousands of hours of combined training and testing over the last couple of years, and all of that had been building towards this goal. Pulling off even one of these records that they were attempting to break, well, it would have been one hell of a way to go out, and really would have finished quite literally on a high for the team. Except they never got that chance to see what was possible. Here we hear from Will Perrett, Kyle Gordon, Dan Bigham and John Archibald about what did happen.
Spent 3 or 4 days out in Tenerife training as normal, and then about on our 5th day, Tenerife and the Canary Islands went into lockdown along with Spain. And all of a sudden we're in a Airbnb 2,500 metres above sea level that doesn't have, you know, you're running off a generator for electricity. You don't have hot water in the tap, you've only got hot shower. Basically we were washing ourselves out of pots and just living a very basic lifestyle. And you're all of a sudden locked in that house, not allowed to leave, you're not allowed to cycle, not allowed to walk. You're in strict lockdown procedures that they were implementing in Tenerife, Spain, the other European countries.
Just before, a couple of days before we left, we also got the news that the complex in Bolivia, where the velodrome is, was being used for COVID patients, and that the record attempts were up. So it was quite a bit of a a real anticlimax for all of us, because we'd gone up there to train, we were training hard, then we couldn't train, and then we were thinking, right, how do we keep ourselves fit if we can't get out the front door? And then eventually the news broke that we wouldn't be able to go out and actually have a crack at the record. So that was, yeah, that was pretty tough for all of us. But again, we were just happy to, at the end of it, get home safe. And we were quite lucky that we could come back here. We did the self-quarantining for a couple of weeks in Derby, and then I think we went our separate ways.
We got a flight back that Thursday. It was quite funny because Will was quite reluctant to leave, but in hindsight we were lucky to get that flight because it was one of the last to leave the island, and if we hadn't got it we could possibly still be there now, so we were pretty lucky to get off in that flight.
Yeah, it's a quarantine zone for Cochabamba, which is the velodrome we were going to go to, so we, even if we wanted or could even get there, there's no way we could have even ridden on the track with hundreds, if not thousands, of people with coronavirus floating around. It was, basically impossible. But I guess a lot of athletes are in the same boat with Tokyo, so there's a lot of sympathy and empathy between all athletes who are in a very, very similar situation at the moment. I think in some ways we're treating it as our Olympics, so it'll happen. We're just going to be patient around all this and respond to the situation as well as we can, not get frustrated by it.
It really was a brutal end to what has been a dream and a whirlwind of a journey over the past couple of years. And in this podcast, we wanted to tell the story from the humble beginnings to being on the cusp of breaking those world records. But of course, we also wanted to geek out about their tech. So we spoke to the chief nerd and the real technological driver behind Hoob What Bike, as it's now known, about the inception of the team and how they managed to take on the world. Here's Dan Bigham.
Well, originally it was actually under the NRG driver plan, which was our road team that year that myself and Charlie Tanfield were riding for. So we wanted to have a go at track that winter. This was late 2016, so the Nationals January 2017. We were just training at Derby, nothing more than that. Just as pursuers, two of us, planning to go there, have a go at the IV, and that would be that. But after spending a bit of time on the track, we started to realise that we were going pretty well, and probably if we drag two of the guys in, we can go and have a go at the team pursuit. I already had a few people in mind. I convinced Johnny, who was at Loughborough Uni at the time, finishing off his psychology degree, that it would be a great idea to join, and he'd only have to do 4 laps in the eject, and that would be fine. So he was in, committed, and I knew he had the gas to do it. He'd been competing at like the British Uni Champs and getting some great results. So he was in, and I then approached Jacob Tipper, who I think Jack was quite keen to get him to join the road team the following year. So I kind of dangled that carrot too, and was like, but mate, we'll go there, we'll win, it'll be great. Get involved. You only have to do four laps and eject as well. Kind of sell him on the same premise. He came back and said no, which is kind of a bit like, oh. I thought you'd be in on that one. I thought I told it really well. But after a few weeks of hounding him, he was over in China at the time. I think he was tour of Kwanzai Lake, maybe. And yeah, managed to convince him. So he came back late December, and we went straight on the track. We had 4 weeks together as a team, and got from a 424 to a 404 at Nationals. And we won. We won, which is pretty cool. Broke the competition records. Beat GB Senior Academy. And yeah, it was a bit of a shock, I think, as quite a successful national championships. But off the back of that, we kind of went our own ways a little bit for a couple of months, back to the road, and just kept training, kept racing, and didn't think too much about how to push it on until we started sort of getting back into the road season and said, well, what are we going to do this winter? How do we step up? And we knew World Cups existed, but not how to access them. So we sent a few emails about, a few phone calls, found out we'd missed the deadline by 2 months to register as the UCI track trade team. But the UCI came back and said, look, if you can get the money together in 2 weeks, we'll let you register. It's £5,000, and this is all the details that we need by then. It was like, oh, great. So we're all well into our overdrafts and credit cards and everything else after just finishing uni. Not exactly flush with money. And how can you get £5,000 in 2 weeks? But a bit of inventiveness and a lot of asking around, and yeah, we managed to pull it together and became what is now known as Team KGF, which is the Karen Green Foundation. So they're a charity based in Nottingham, in memory of Karen Green, who is Ellie Green's mum. She passed away from leukemia back in about 9 years ago now, 2011, 2012. And yeah, it was the fact that we didn't have any commercial sponsors, so we thought it would make a lot more sense to race under the name of a charity, and Ellie was super keen to help out on the sort of managerial side and just logistical stuff. Her dad ran a bike shop, which was really helpful too, in having access to the trade accounts, and just a good mechanic as well was really beneficial. And Ellie's gone on to some great things. She works for Team Ineos now as well, so it's been like a sort of stepping stone for her, just like I think it has for all of us, really. And yeah, at the time we didn't think anything more than that. We thought we'd go to the World Cups and it'd be good fun and let's see what happens, but never had any super ambitions of continually, well, I don't know, go to world champs, breaking world records, trying to go to the Olympics, any of that stuff. It was just, let's do everything as well as we can, as professionally as we can, and tick all those little performance boxes and see what comes of it, really.
Those of you who followed the team's progress over the years will know that they are famous for pushing the limits of the UCI rules. I spoke to Dan about this, and he had something really pretty interesting to say about rules.
I think it's something I've naturally always had. I get quite obsessive over things that I get involved in to make sure they're as good as they can be. Even back in 2015-16, when I was taking up road racing, I was probably a little bit more detail focused on the equipment side and positional side than most were. So things like aero stocks or narrow handlebars. So even back in 2015, I was running 36 centimetre handlebars and got a lot of weird looks for that. So yeah, it's something I've had since back in the Formula One days when I worked for Mercedes AMG Petronas, which is 2012. And you kind of get taught a lot of, I guess, good mental approaches to problems and to rule books and regulations of how to tackle them, how to sort of read the rules with an approach that basically works in your benefit that other people might not. Rules are often written with an intent, but the intent isn't actually what gets sort of put across. There might be sort of spirit, but the spirit doesn't matter. It's just the words on the paper, and if you can read them in a different way that gets you an advantage, then we by all means do. So it's something that's been instilled in me for basically nearly 10 years now through university and through working in motorsport, and yeah, bringing that approach to cycling has been pretty successful so far.
Now, I thought that was pretty interesting. I think listening to that really articulated the thought processes behind the way this team has just pushed the limits of the rules. There isn't even a need to tear up the rule book. You can just twist it and turn it a little bit to make it read the way that you want it to. And that being said, some of these rule pushes clearly pushed the UCI to their limit as well, and to the point when they pushed back. Here's what Dan had to say about some of the bigger challenges and frustrations of trying to push the rules to breaking point and have the UCI push back and change their rules as a result.
Some things have been frustrating. Some things have been quite enjoyable. I think every problem just presents itself with an opportunity. And a lot of the regulations they've changed have been around extensions and handlebars and risers and a lot of the sort of front end things that we've always looked to sort of circumnavigate our way around. Like the 10 centimetre rule by having longer pads, thicker foam, higher angles, holding on with one finger, all these kind of little tweaks, and bit by bit the UCI have tightened us and painted us back into a corner. I mean, there was even one, we worked with a partner in Barbados called Pentaxia, who developed, we developed together a new base bar, riser and extension system. And then we went to our first World Cup in Minsk about 3 days before the UCI changed the regulations that effectively made one part of it that was quite critical illegal, which is a bit frustrating at the time. But then you go back to the drawing board and you think, maybe I could have done that better. And then found some good assistance from the Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre in Sheffield, who said they'd machine some new components for us if we could get them designed in about 3 days. So it was kind of a quick rush, fit the new regulations. We actually ended up with a faster component because of it. So sometimes a bit of pressure to do things differently results in getting more performance. So I think that's kind of been the case over the past three seasons, where they always change the rules a little bit and you have to think of it differently, but often end up with a faster product because of it.
Listening to that, I thought what was quite eye-opening for me particularly is how the rule changes are forcing such a high turnover of innovative design and numbers of design iterations. Every time a rule changes, this team just goes, nah, okay, we'll do that. And how can we do it better?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing to see how their partners have stepped up. There's so many passionate people surrounding the team who just want to see them go faster. And that is the exact same way that they approached actually riding the team pursuit. Back in the 2017 National Championships, which is where they broke onto the scene and they just won medals left, right and centre, they had this crazy approach where they just burnt up man one of their four-man team pursuit in the first four or five laps. It wasn't something that had been seen before in competition, and it really broke the mould of how to ride the team pursuit, and one that other nations soon began to try and imitate, although not necessarily with the same success that Hoob Watt Bike had seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think when they first started, Johnny was riding from the man one position and riding four or five laps and then bailing from that position. That developed slightly to him starting at man, when I joined the team, to starting at man two. Johnny would start at man two and then Dan would do the first lap and Johnny would ride four to five laps and bail from there. So certainly there was very few people, nobody really, riding a single turn strategy where you only hit the front once. So it wasn't just Johnny riding, you know, one turn and bailing. After that, you then had, you know, all of us pulling three to four lap turns to get to the line without hitting the front more than once. So it was a very different strategy to what had been seen. And it was, you know, proving effective for us. And then in particular when we encountered struggles with getting me off the start line at man four, you know, quickly enough, we started implementing a totally new strategy where man one would start the race but not drop to the back of the line after the first lap, he'd drop into man three position, so he would fill the gap that I left, that was totally, you know, new, and I don't think anyone's copied that scenario. And you know, we found out that later on it's not necessarily optimal, but it was optimal for that situation of that crop of riders. You know, we later developed it to where, you know, we improved my start a bit and we didn't need to do it anymore. But that was the thing, was we were trying strategies that nobody else seemed to be, well, whether they were thinking of them or not, they certainly weren't trying them. And there was a very strict sort of turn strategy of one and a half to maybe a two lap turn. And then you had people like Charlie pulling, you know, four and a half lap turns. So it was, yeah, I think there's a lot to learn from what they brought in.
That's really funny. I was trying not to laugh when you were saying about you're missing your start. I remember the videos and, you know, the guys taking the piss out of you, because, I mean, you're so valuable in the team pursuit, and it was just that challenge of getting off the start line quick enough so that you were in the line.
It's your life flashing before your eyes. I mean, you can't believe it that, you know, you're starting from man four, the most, you know, technically the easiest position to start from, because you're getting free rider gap in front of you to close that gap. And like, I just watched them ride away, and the whole thing was just like, it was daunting. I'd get to the start line and think, today is not the day, John. Do not let it happen. And you know, it reached a point where they had to change the strategy to adapt it so that I could get on. And then eventually, obviously, once it went long enough, I was, you know, in terms of training and what I could improve, we didn't need to do it anymore. So I did it for a season, and then the second season, I didn't need to do it. But there were some daunting moments, especially the London World Cup, where I've seen photographs of me off the back by, you know, it looks like 15 or 20 metres. And then I'm riding technically the fastest lap split of the race because I'm closing into a gap from, you know, right at the back there, and, you know, riding speeds that are just crazy. But in the meantime, I've got that all going through my head, and nobody can even see behind me what's going on, because I daren't shout hold, because it ruins the whole team. Like, especially off the first lap when you're accelerating up to speed and then you want to settle at speed and hold it. Someone shouting hold that early into the race just scuppers the whole dynamic and whole flow of the race. So that was my main aim, was like, do not shout hold, do not shout hold.
So that was John Archibald there talking about his personal struggles getting off the start line at the London World Cup, an event which saw them take a glorious gold medal in an exciting final with Belgium. But I think it raises quite an interesting point. At the end of the day, you can find as much speed as you like and save as many watts as you can with all the gear, but unless you put in the hours, you know, it's no substitute for putting in the hours of work, is it, at all? And you need to combine all of this together with the testing and all that equipment and finding out what works for you. Because without just one of those things, you're just not going to make it to the top.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And I spoke to a few of the riders about their thoughts on which of these technological aspects that were available to them through the team gave them the biggest advantage after joining the team. And I'll say now, it was pretty interesting to hear the varying opinions. First off, his newest recruit, Kyle Gordon's experience of his biggest technological game changer for his performance.
I would say the aero testing side of things, you know, was something I could never do myself. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't have the equipment to do it. Basically, as soon as I got on, Dan showed me what to do, gave me the device, the Noshio Connect, for doing our own aero testing at the track, and, you know, he would analyse our stuff. So it was just, you know, you can train as hard as you want, but, you know, if you can find 50 watts in your position and equipment, then, you know, that's the way you want to go. So, having that, I found that the biggest gain, you know, getting access to do my aero testing and, yeah, find gains that way. And equipment, you know. But, yeah, the equipment came after, obviously, the aero testing, because I tested numerous, you know, pieces of stuff. You know, a certain helmet might not work for everybody, you know, so it was like finding the right things, the right suit, the right helmet, the right shoes and pedals that suited my body shape, you know, and position. So that was the best bit I found.
In terms of actual numbers, when you're describing the reduction in drag coefficient that you experienced from changes in position, what did that actually equate to in terms of power saving and watts on the track?
In total, from my position when I rocked up with my own bike, when I went onto the new bike and my new position, helmet and stuff, I think it was around about 50 watts, I think it was, about 50 watts that I saved, you know, which is a massive chunk of time. I couldn't tell you the exact amount of time. I'm not a spreadsheet kind of guy, but I definitely noticed the difference. You know?
I mean, it's just, 50 watts is just huge. It's absolutely massive. It's like the difference between an amateur who hasn't trained and a professional who trains. I mean, it can, or maybe in women's level, it can be, you know, it could be more than, it could be a lot more than that, obviously, but it's a huge amount.
Yeah.
That you can save just from, you know, without actually doing any more training, which is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. You can train, you can train all day, you can train every day, but, you know, to go and find 50 watts in training will take you months, you know, months. Once you're up there, certain level of certain ability, it's all marginal gains, you know, so to it basically felt like taking a sail off my back, you know, a parachute. You know, it felt like taking a parachute off my back. And, you know, once I got it all together, the new bike, new handlebars, you know, everything that sort of came together, definitely felt the benefits, you know.
It was quite exciting moving into the house in the first place. And then it was great to be in there and see all the tech and all the cool kit that I'd never been able to have my hands on before as a student cyclist. So that was great.
Now tech, that's where we're really talking, because that's obviously what we like to talk about a lot on this podcast. So once you moved into the house, you know, what kind of things were you really able to get your hands on that you weren't able to use previously?
So this will probably surprise you, but I'd never used a on-track power meter. So I'd never been able to, just analyze my own data. It was very much before I'd have my power meter on the road to do my road training and on the turbo. But actually on the track, I'd still say not that many people have on-track power meters. To get my hands on one of those and actually seeing the numbers I did was just, yeah, it was so useful. And then secondly, because the team's sponsored by No Show Connect, we were able to do some of my own aero testing, which again I had never done. I had very much eyeballed previously, and then with a bit of Dan's advice. Dan's always very much about teaching riders how to do things and not just doing everything for them, because if you're involved in the process, you buy into it more. So I would go down and like every week do a different aero test, testing a different thing to optimize my position. So that was one of the first things I did when I joined the team, was basically get me optimized in the pursuit position.
Well, that just shows the importance of testing. And again, we come back to your favorite subject, CDA.
Yeah, absolutely. And also it brings in maybe the need for this new body rocket that you were talking about at the top of the show, and their competitor who are already out there, the No Show Connect. And No Show Connect is something that the team have been using. It allows you to measure your CDA in real time on the track. And obviously these guys had access to the track as well. And so they were able to do this track testing day in, day out, measuring, testing different things, like every day, finding out what was the best. Is this position better? Is this position better? Is this skin suit better? Are these wheels better? And really that volume and intensity of testing is what enabled them to kind of make these gains.
Well, I hate to stop you in your airflow there, Lizzie. It's a good gag, isn't it? So let's move on to have a bit more of a look at some of the more specific equipment that the team have been using. I think one of the things that's so fascinating has been the look of the team through the years. And one of the things that stands out most is probably the image of the guys in their famous flying saucer-like helmets that do look as if, you know, they look like something out of a sort of a sci-fi B-movie, basically.
Yeah, it's funny. I think the guys say themselves that we're the guys that look really weird, but we go really fast. And these helmets, as they're fondly known by the team, the skid lids, are something that have become iconic and really just associated with their team. And I think it's really interesting how they've pioneered the use of this 10-year-old helmet. And when they first started using it, people didn't even recognize that it was a legal helmet. Here's what Dan Bigham had to say about using it in competition.
Yeah, it was quite funny. I remember Paris World Cup, the first World Cup season in 2018-19, and the commissaire just looking at the lid, it's like, not seen that, and then came up, he's like, can you show me inside the helmet, please? Like, is that passed? Is that legal? And I'm like, yeah, it's fine. This helmet's been out for over a decade. What are you on about? But yeah, it wasn't POC who was sponsoring us. In fact, you can't even buy them direct from POC at the moment. I think the plan probably is to bring them back out with how popular they've been. But yeah, that was just one of them. We tested them, they worked out really fast in our position, so it was an absolute no-brainer to just go and use them. But yeah, the UCI was scratching their heads, and then they became like, well, just rare as the five of them when we realised they were quick and thought, well, no one else is going to be able to get them, so we just keep our hands on them and no one else can copy us then. And yeah, the price has gone up and up. I think retail, they used to be about 300, and their going rate is £500-600 now, which is madness.
That's brilliant. I mean, like, that's a classic example of people always thinking that newer is better, and actually the best thing is to test everything and then find out what's best, not just assume that something is best because the marketing info says so. But yeah, that's really cool.
It's a common problem, I think, in the cycling industry, isn't it, that people look at what the pros use and assume what the pros use in the fastest kit, but having looked under the hood, as it were, world tour teams and even some nations, they're riding equipment because they're paid to ride equipment, not because it's the fastest. And it's common frustration for a lot of professional riders that they're having to ride substandard equipment or slower equipment than previous editions because that's what the sponsor is demanding of them. Whereas we're in the lucky situation of we ride what's fastest, and if we can get the fastest equipment company to sponsor us, then even better. But on the whole, we just find the funds to then buy the equipment that we know we need.
Isn't that great? Just as what we were saying before, test everything, find out what's best, what's fastest, and then try and get those guys on board as sponsors. And that's exactly the same story as what happened with Argon too. The team started using these bikes because they found out that there was a small aero advantage over the Cervelo T4s that they'd been previously using. So they bought all the frames that they needed with the help of a financial sponsor. And then Argon, the next year, hearing about their story and what they were doing, decided to get involved, gave them custom Darbados paint jobs and as many frames as they needed.
Lizzie, you mentioned Darbados there. I'm sure most people know what that is. I know it really well, growing up in the East Midlands. Darbados, the wonderful city of Derby.
Yeah, the People's Republic of Darbados, the home of cycling in Britain. And you can buy a t-shirt with that slogan on, and it's like a bit of a jive towards British cycling and the home of cycling in Britain up in Manchester. But all of this also raises a bit of an interesting point about professional riders and the challenges of having to ride kit, which maybe you know isn't actually the fastest out there, or at least isn't the fastest for you. So an example from the women's side was Linda Willemsen back in the 2015 Richmond World Championships. She decided to use an unbranded Trek frame in the World Time Trial Championships, and her team, United Healthcare, was sponsored by Villiers. She didn't actually tell the team at the time, and so the first thing that they knew of it was when it was on the TV. So they had a bit of a shock. Their sponsors were pretty mad. And then more recently, there's the example with Rowan Dennis, and famously at last year's Tour de France, he left the Tour the day before the time trial, owing supposedly to a disagreement about time trialing equipment. So it can be a real challenge when ultimately all you want to do is go as fast as you possibly can, but restrictions surrounding contracts can stop you doing that.
Well, there's the question of whether you could lose a Grand Tour because you have to wear the leader's jersey in a time trial. And, you know, possibly you could. We've seen those videos of Chris Froome getting stitched into that not very aero skin suit at the Tour de France. Here's what Will Perrott had to say about his experience of getting a custom laser-fitted skin suit and the subsequent testing and the sudden reality of how much time can be lost with substandard equipment.
So our skin suits are from Huben Vortec. And when we initially went down to Silverstone, where Vortec are based, they initially did a body scan of us on our bike. So one of the guys at Vortec, they went round us while we were on our bikes. We were actually topless at the time, so obviously you can see the contours of your skin and absolutely everything and how you're positioned. And this full body scan effectively takes the exact measurements, probably to, I couldn't tell you the accuracy, but practically of all your skin folds as well. And it gives you, yeah, this perfect 3D model. And it just basically that allowed them to design a custom suit specifically for your body shape and in your position, and then we were able to then go and test different fabrics and different skin suits on different riders, and we found that we were four riders riding the same helmet, same bikes, extremely similar positions. If you see us in photos, sometimes it's hard to distinguish which rider's which. But we're all coming out with slightly different results based on our fabrics, based on the angle of our arms, the size of our biceps. If you know, some of the guys with bigger biceps, which aren't me, they require a slightly different fabric to riders like myself that's got slightly skinnier biceps. Just based on how the air's flowing off each individual rider. So it was extremely fascinating to be there, to be able to test these things and have specific suits for effectively each individual rider. And I think it's going more that direction, that skin suits are basically, they're having to be designed for the specific rider riding. There were some suits like the Hoop 409 that seemed to, that's an off the peg suit and seemed to test fast on all of us. But then there are other suits that just test slow or quick, depending on the shape and size of the person, and probably how similar that person is to the person that developed the suit in the first place. Over a 4K pursuit, it would be about, you could get the variance of about 10 watts, which I guess
we'll ask Dan what that means.
Yeah.
But I mean, 10 watts, yeah, you know, you'd pay a lot for 10 watts.
It'll be a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
And that's why for each rider, you have to do your own testing. And again, we tested all the suits in the tunnel and then we got back and tested them back on the track. You obviously hold your position slightly differently when you're putting out your power. And then again, there are different variants in that. So that's why you just have to just test, and then retest a few more times just to really, really know for sure. But definitely with skin suits, it's bonkers. You will put on so many different skin suits and then, and you can just pull out completely different answers. And what was bizarre was, myself and Johnny were wearing the same skin suit. John was really fast in the 409, and so was Kyle. And then we had the new Tokyo skin suit come out, and that was supposed to be the quickest thing around. And it tested really quick on John and then Johnny, which are completely different body shapes, but didn't test as quick as the Hoop Vortec one on me. So it was just quite baffling, really, because these guys at Vortec really, really know what they're talking about. But even then, there's things that just throw up because air just isn't, it's all based down to your position that you're riding in, the shape of the person, and I think it's more or less impossible to, you can design a quick suit that's quick on most people, but really if each rider needs their own suit developing for them, really that's the way that it will end up going forward. And then again, then the people or teams that have the most money or want to choose to invest in that type of thing, they'll be the ones that are coming out on top.
Yeah, it's bonkers. And I mean, you know, we're talking here about a 4K team pursuit, and obviously, you know, the margins in team pursuit are so, so fine, you know, tenths of a second less. But, you know, when you look at those numbers about the skin suit and then you scale that up to a road time trial, you know, in the men's time trials, which are longer, you could be looking at 45 seconds, which is massive.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely massive.
Oh, yeah. It's ridiculous. Mm. Like, there's all that talk about certain riders having to wear the leader's jersey on the final ride of a Grand Tour and losing out on the Grand Tour by, I don't know, could be a couple of seconds or small margins, but really they've lost themselves 30 seconds in that time trial by just riding the leader's jersey. So it's bonkers, and I don't know how you would go about changing that. Maybe you'd just have to make sure each team has a skin suit or something in the leader's colours and branded up like them, but their own skin suit. I don't know.
Oh, Lizzie, that is bonkers. That is absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, it is bonkers. I mean, we heard Will saying there that maybe there was a 10-watt variance between the top-end skin suits on different riders. But when I spoke to John, he told me that the difference between a bad skin suit and a good skin suit can be as much as 30 watts. And certainly for him, it was the biggest gain that he found out of all of the things that he tested whilst he was in the team. The final bit of tech that I wanted to focus on is the team's choice of wheels. It's pretty clear from speaking to Dan that they never use equipment just for the sake of it. Not, you know, they never get an equipment sponsor because they're getting funded. So it was really interesting to see them use a wheel brand that hasn't really been in the public eye until they highlighted their potential. And even now, after the proven success of the wheels, they seem pretty rare. So I spoke to Dan about the team's partnership with Brother Walker Wheels and how the innovative design actually allows them to fulfil their own mantra of test, 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 without the associated costs of buying so many different wheel sets.
Just before we went to our first nationals, we were, I wouldn't say picking up partners, but speaking with companies to see what they had and how they could help us, and Brian Walker was one of the first ones there. I'd seen some cool designs that he'd been working on. He effectively builds a wheel very different to how most other wheel companies do. See that you would usually have a spoked wheel or a carbon composite wheel where you have the carbon fibre in what's known as epoxy matrix, you end up with a rock solid wheel. So if you went and knocked your knuckles onto any disc wheel out there, it'd sound pretty solid, whereas if you knock it on ours, it's actually really, really soft, and people find that quite odd, because what we've actually got is just carbon fibre cloth with no plastic matrix, effectively just under tension under the skin. So it's kind of, in a way, a little bit similar to the Dynama string spokes that have become a bit more popular in the hill climb world of late. So you effectively just run cloth strings from a hub to the rim bed, and it just means you have a light, stiff wheel. But then you can put an aero skin on top, so you can change the aero profile to your heart's content without actually worrying about the structural side of the wheel. Which just means for us, we've been developing the wheel since 2017 onwards, and just continually iterate without having to spend a lot of money on new molds and new components, which is quite a nice way of doing it, really. It's a cheap way of getting fast.
It doesn't appeal to me, Lizzie, living with my teammates, but I wonder what difference it made having all the guys living together under one roof. I mean, it clearly worked for them.
I think it's a massive benefit. You know, you've got five like-minded people to be around. It just makes everything, you know, a lot easier. Training, you know, I'm very self-motivated anyway, but, you know, if you ever do have a day when you think, oh God, I don't know if I can do it today, you've got one of the boys saying, get on your bike, you know what I mean? You're not due your rest day yet. So, like, having that extra push, just, you know, having that guy around you just makes everything so much easier, you know? You know, living with five people, you've got five brains to go and pick people for. You know, if you've got a thought or you've got an idea or you're confused about something, you can, you know, we've got them at our fingertips, you know, just go knock the bedroom door, get in there and have a chat. You know, probably the biggest one is just having Dan, you know, in the same house, you know, anything we needed to know, he'd have the answer. So having him, you know, pop into his room anytime, ask him something, he'd be always able to help us out, point us in the right direction if not. So yeah, I don't know, I should say, like, if we had had benefits that got, I would say, definitely got the best out of each other.
That was Kyle Gordon there. And I heard it mentioned so many times when I was talking to the guys that having Dan there on hand was such a big factor in the ability to constantly improve. Having Dan's brain was about the best bit of tech the teams could get their hands on, really. But something that I wanted to know about, which was a little bit more complicated, is how do you get the whole team of riders to peak at the same time for the same event? Here's what John Archibald had to say.
That is the hardest bit in itself, is you've got four or five guys potentially turning up to a event, and you've got them all have to be in peak form for one or two given days. So you're qualifying one night, and the following day you have rounds and finals. And I'm not sure anyone would agree we found a day where all four or five of us were in form. You could pick out rides where certain people had very good rides, certain people had very bad rides. It's never seemed to be the case that all four or five of you could peak for the one event. And I think that's a specialty in itself. And the nature of having, you know, four events in a year where you're trying to peak for them, and say you have the series that year in 2018-19 looked as though you had Paris, first of all, and then literally the next week we went to Canada and raced there, and we had a two-week break, and went to Berlin, raced there, and then the next week you're racing in London. So there's, you know, you're talking four races in a very short space of time where, you know, there's very little time to fix things that are wrong, even in terms of, you know, peaking and tapering. It's just whole that side of it is very complicated, I think. And I don't know, you know, if you speak to national governing bodies, I'm sure they have the same issue where you get three riders, you know, pinging on form, and then there might just be that one that's not made it. And, it's just the nature of it, I think. You never, you know, if you strive for perfection, but can these things really be achieved? I don't know. And I guess when they are, you get the four Danish riding 3:44 in good conditions, good form, and they all blunder, and I guess it can happen. It's just can happen when you want it to. And I think in London, we're in a position where we all, four of us, performed solidly. I wouldn't say it was perfect, but we all reached a point where, you know, if you're looking at that World Cup and going, it's a home World Cup, we're favourites, we want to win it. We've had some good experiences in the past. We've already won a medal in Canada, done some good at the fast time in Paris. The whole thing's been building to a point where you look at London and going, right, this is our chance. And I think, you know, with a lot of support in the crowd, a lot of people come to see us, a lot of people that we were looking to perform in front of. And it was ended up being very tight, actually, in the final with Belgium. You know, it came right down to the wire, and it was an exciting race to watch, I believe. So, you know, the way it all went, and it was not, I wouldn't call it, you know, fairy tale ending, but it was a, you know, great end to the season in terms of we then did that London World Cup, went to Switzerland the week after that for Christmas time, and you know, rode some really fast IP times. At that time, it was, you know, people were calling it sea level world record in the IP, and that was where, well, things started to get, you know, a bit more. It became less of a hobby and more of a, oh well, this is you know, it's taking another step up, another level of seriousness, and how far can you really push it? I think that was always the case.
Well, the team were aiming to break the Team Pursuit world record. That Team Pursuit world record, before they got to do it, was actually lowered, wasn't it, by Denmark, pretty dramatically, and with what seemed to be pretty basic equipment.
Yeah, so what happened there was Dan really gave himself a bit of a headache. He had been working with the Denmark Team Pursuit team and with two other aerodynamicists as well there. And with his help, they really completely smashed the world record time and ended up taking 3 seconds, which in track times is massive, off the world record time. So here's Dan talking about the bittersweet taste of success of the Danish world record time.
It was a weird one. I thoroughly enjoyed that week in Berlin, and seeing those times was just outrageous, knowing where they were now and what was to come as well. It was pretty amazing. But I think a lot of that comes back to the fact that the team is so focused on doing things right. They're kind of a slightly better funded version of Who What Bike in a way now, when we have good R&D squads. There's myself, Casperman Folsak, and Martin Top Madsen. So there's three of us basically doing the job that I'd normally do for Who What Bike. And for example, I've just been in Denmark and I've done a week of 12-hour days of aero testing, and it's just something we'd never be able to afford. So they've just got the manpower really to fight all the big giants who have all the big funding, and I quite like that. It's enjoyable, it's fun, it's just another frontier to get involved with. In a way, yeah, it's frustrating for our record attempts, and coronavirus has really hit that even harder. So So 3:44 was a bit of a stretch goal, but if you don't go up and try, then you'll never really know. And even if we ended up and did a 45 or a 46, then I'd still be content that we tried and we put that marker down, because I know what the Danes achieved and how they achieved it was just, yeah, astronomical. And sure, we're not as strong as them. We might be pretty good team pursuers, but there's no replacement for putting out big power numbers. You can always get people more aero, but you can't always make them stronger. So I think that was why they did such an outrageous performance back in coronavirus has been the worst one for it, though. I think we're in a really good spot back in March and April with our Tenerife Valve shoe camps and all the preparation that we've done ahead of it, that if we'd gone up, then I was very confident we'd come back with at least one world record. It's taken some work to get all the logistics in place with timing and commissaires and anti-doping and all the other stuff that goes with putting on an event in a country you've never been to in a language you don't speak, but we were ready to roll and obviously got caught in lockdown over in Tenerife, and now basically stuck in Europe and the UK and not able to go and do it until really God knows when.
You know, everyone got a real shock when Denmark went so fast in the World Championships 15 pursuit. So before, prior to that point, the world record had been 3:48, and you know, our fastest time had been 3:52. We were hoping that, you know, we'd go to altitude, make the preparation that we needed to, and you know, 3:48 would be something that was, you know, certainly we saw ourselves doing that kind of time, or 3:47 to beat it rather. And then Denmark going 3:44, you know, changed the game massively, and I think you know, still saw ourselves as able to progress and make significant gains, but it's all a question of can you do it in the time. And you know, with even the Olympics coming up, you can see that record go again and again, and it's just the nature of world records that they just always fall and always improve. And certainly it was exciting, you know, chasing that thrill of riding fast times. So we'll see how it continues from here, yeah.
So for the time being, altitude is clearly out of the question. What about the possibility of breaking these records at sea level?
Certainly team pursuit, I don't see that be reachable at sea level. The way that Denmark are just far ahead of the rest of the world. Certainly, I think a lot of nations got shocked when they started riding those quick times. If you're looking at things like the IP, you've got guys like Ashton, for example, who was you know, only a second behind Filippo Ganna in the World Championship final, and he kind of showed that, you know, it wasn't sort of mutant form that, you know, nobody's capable of. Certainly, he's put himself in that bracket, being able to ride, you know, close to 4 minutes for IP at sea level. Which he did at Berlin, did 4:03. But I think the appetite for these records, you know, suddenly it certainly subsided for me once you realised that, you know, there's no access to velodromes, there's no access to gyms, there's no access to flights, to training camps for altitude. There's just even a sea level world record, you know, getting in a velodrome and doing these things, the whole logistics of the process are suddenly ruled out for you. And it's just, even if you could figure out a way to engineer the process and get you know, the ball rolling and organize it, I think a lot of the motivation, well, for me personally, is subsided for now. And I think you know, I'm looking at other targets for the time being and sort of relishing the idea of something new rather than what's been the cycle of the last few years, where you move straight from track to road and without a break, and you're just always chasing the fitness that you feel, you know, I've had time like this to rebuild. You'd feel it would benefit you as a rider. So as fortunate as this whole situation is in terms of, well, the cost to nationwide in terms of the whole coronavirus situation, but from a cycling point of view, then yeah, it's not necessarily the worst story in the world.
Interesting there to hear about how the motivation varied for all the riders. For me, it's such a shame that they couldn't fulfill. I mean, they've done so much in such a short time, but I really wanted to see it culminate in those record attempts. I mean, are they going to try anything at all?
Well, yeah, it is interesting to hear how different riders have different motivations. And we heard John talking there, but Dan told me he was still planning to attempt an hour record when velodromes open up. And Kyle was saying how he still wants to go for some of the Scottish Masters records, and he's just as motivated as ever, and how actually there's a long-term loose plan with Scottish cycling aiming towards medals at the 2022 Commonwealth Games in Birmingham.
Well, that was just a small snippet of the crazy whirlwind story that was the development of Team Hoop What Bike. The UCI has enabled their rise and demise, but Will is determined that this isn't the end for the team.
We will keep speaking to the UCI and keep, you know, trying to hammer on the door and knock down those barriers to let us try and compete at the highest level. So it's rubbish, but hopefully in the future they'll come to their senses and we'll be able to get the opportunity.
So, well, I know Dan is still very much massively involved in cycling, you know, making a difference for world tour teams all over the place and being employed by different teams. But what do you think the legacy of Team Hoop Watt Bike is?
I think the legacy is so far reaching that it's impossible to measure. You know, can you attribute all of the huge reduction in kind of track times over the past few years to the development and the innovation pushed by Hoop Watt Bike and Team KGF, as they were formerly known? I don't know. Yes, of course, all the nations are still developing, but maybe the development wouldn't have happened quite as fast. They really have been the world leaders in things like skin suit development and on-track testing and just the way that they have pushed it so fast, and they've pushed these designs in handlebars, and they've been the ones that have caused the UCI to push back and change their rules. So yes, things would have developed, but I don't think things would have developed as fast without a team like this pushing those boundaries. You've got to have somebody pushing those boundaries, and then times will fall. And so that's what I think their legacy is, you know, really these absolutely massive reductions in world record times over the past 4 years.
Well, that was a fascinating episode. We're going to leave it there. In the meantime, we'll be back again at the end of this month. But as we said at the start, Lizzie, you are in racing action. So we can watch you on the BBC in the... What's the event called?
It's the Women's Tour V Series. And yeah, I'm going to be entering beast mode.
And if people want to find out about it, your Twitter is probably one of the best places to go to, isn't it? So what's your Twitter?
Twitter or Instagram, yeah, elizzybanks.
Well, I look forward to seeing you start at 350 watts and finish at 350 watts.
Yeah, well, let's hope the race is only 5 minutes long then, because I'm not really sure how much longer I can sustain that, but it's going to be brutal for sure.
This episode of Service Course was produced by me. Our theme music is Beyond the Black Veil by the brilliant Moscow Youth Cult. Do go and check them out. Additional music also comes from Moscow Youth Cult's John Dix. Thanks as ever, John. And the rest of the tracks in the show come via Epidemic Sound. For details of the individual tracks, then please check the show notes. Thanks again.